Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yes, a US military codebreaker called Parker Hit said in 1916, success in dealing with unknown ciphers is measured by these four things in the order named. Perseverance, careful methods of analysis, intuition, and luck. Tonight on the show, we're going to explore all aspects of code breaking, from World War II successes like Alan Turing, who helped the British government pioneer the technology which decrypted Nazi Germany's secret communications at Bletchley Park, once the top secret home of the World War II codebreakers. And we'll throw into the mix some basic questions too. Why do we have codes, and what kind of mind do you need to break them? Is there such a thing as an uncrackable code? And what role does modern computing have in creating and cracking codes? Joining us tonight, Professor Graham Farr from the Faculty of IT at Monash University. Graham, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening, Philip. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you along. Also joining us tonight, Dr. Richard Bean from the University of Queensland's Redback Technologies Research Centre. Richard, good evening to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, great to have both of you with us. It's a wonderful sort of smoky room topic, isn't it? Codes and code breaking. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of how codes are cracked and written, I'd like to start with the story of two men, Bill Tutt and the more well-known Alan Turing. Now, Graham, you call Bill Tutt one of the greatest mathematicians and code breakers in the 20th century. Tell me about him. Who was he?
Yeah, Bill Tutt was a shy, retiring, but brilliant Englishman born in 1917, grew up in the north in East Anglia part of England, went to Cambridge as an undergraduate in the late 30s, and brilliantly solved an unsolved mathematical sort of puzzle question in those days, which really made an impact on some of the Cambridge some of the Cambridge academics who taught him. And this drew him to their attention so that they roped him into the code-breaking effort at Bletchley Park. Mm-hmm. So, in brief, he was recruited to Bletchley Park in around about 1941 and was put to work on a really difficult unsolved problem to crack the toughest code that was used at the highest levels by the Nazi regime. This was a code operated using a cipher machine called Lorenz. That was just the make of it. Mm-hmm. And the British didn't even know how it worked. I mean, the first
this,
step...
Was this different to the Enigma machine, or this is what we're talking about?
Sort of a much more advanced version, related but more complicated and using some different technology as well. Inside the Enigma machine, there were three rotating wheels, which mm-hmm. rotated in such as to, a way as to create many, many, many different possibilities for encrypting the letters of the message that was to be encoded. Whereas the Lorenz machine had not three, but 12 of these wheels, which multiplied the number of possibilities. Well, it made them grow exponentially and made it a fiendishly difficult problem. Even worse than that, as far as the Lorenz machine was concerned, they didn't even know initially how it worked. And so that was the first problem that they had to surmount.
Right. Okay. Yes. This Lorenz, was this Lorenz cipher used throughout the war, or was it only in the latter stages?
From about mid-war, I think it wasn't used at the very start. It was sort of new modern technology in some ways, sort of an advance on the technology of the Enigma machines, a bit more reliance on electrical mechanisms. But it was very important. It was used at the highest levels of the Nazi regime, and the Allies, once they were able to listen to it, were able at times to know in real time what what their enemies were planning.
Yeah, Bill Tutt died in 2002, and you say he was never really recognised for his achievements. A lot of people know Alan Turing, but I suspect none of us have heard of Bill Tutt.
That's right. He was a more conventional sort of person. Alan Turing was very unusual, and there was the romantic and tragic story of his life.
Turing was treated appallingly, wasn't it?
Absolutely terribly. Tut's life followed, I guess, a more conventional, less spectacular course, one might say. And he was a very retiring personality, not so conspicuous in his social ways, I guess. But he was a real quiet achiever. When he first went to Bletchley Park, he was given this incredibly difficult problem to solve, where they didn't even know how the Lorentz machine worked. He was noticed by his colleagues, sort of sitting, staring out of the window, doodling on a piece of paper, and you'd wonder what he was really doing. Was he being productive? But he really was. He came up with the key ideas that led to diagnosing how this machine worked.
I don't know whether we how good we all are at maths, but when he was at he rose to fame, as you say, at university by solving difficult problems, including sharing with other students a game called Squaring the Square.
Oh, yes.
Is it possible to explain to us humble people who never got past arithmetic what Squaring the Square is?
Yes, sure. So it's a simply stated geometric problem. The question was, can you divide a square into a finite number of smaller squares, all of different sizes? So that's all. You've got to come up with you start with a big square and you want a whole lot of smaller square tiles that
will all be square
without any gaps. Yeah, they're all squares. You put them together, no gaps, so that they make up exactly the shape of the big square. And, just a sort of recreational puzzle, really. Its origins go back to about 1902 in a British puzzle magazine. But it had been conjectured to be impossible. And Tut and three of his friends found a solution and found a whole theory of constructing solutions to that puzzle.
Okay, all right. So you say really he ought to be recognised more, particularly for his work on the Lorentz cipher, which does sound fiendishly difficult. Well, we'll talk about that again in a minute, and also the great Alan Turing, of course. But I'd like to bring in Dr. Richard Bean from the University of Queensland's Redback Technologies Research Centre here too. Richard, simple question, I guess. Why do we need codes anyway? You've got a great way of explaining this to your students.
Well, the traditional way of explaining it is to say that there are two people who want to communicate, and you could call them A and B, but you usually just call them Alice and Bob after the 1960s movie Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. So Alice and Bob, they want to communicate with each other, but there's someone listening in at the window, Eve, the eavesdropper, and they don't want Eve to know what they're saying. So they want to sort of scramble their communications. It might be just like a speech scrambler, or it might be all digital communication like email. But they don't want the eavesdropper to be able to intercept what they're saying or communicating and be able to understand it.
Yes, and indeed. I mentioned that those four things at the beginning: perseverance, careful methods of analysis, intuition, and luck. What percentage of cracking a code is luck?
When people do something magnificent, they always want to say, "Oh, it was hard work," but and they say, you make your own luck when you work hard enough on something, but it's a significant proportion of it, I would have to say, yeah.
What sort of mind do you have to crack a code? Is it just mathematics? Or do you need some other kind of mind?
No, actually, historically, linguists have been very great code breakers as well, and musicians. So it seems to come down to pattern recognition. So if you can, that English always has these patterns in it. So like the letter Q is always followed by the letter U in English, and TH is usually followed by a vowel or an R. THR. So with some encryption algorithms, you see that that structure still persists after the text is encrypted. So what you need, even for more modern encryption algorithms to break them, is you need to be able to recognize patterns and be able to exploit those patterns to break the code.
Mm. Yes, okay. You managed in 2019 to decrypt a difficult code that, despite expert code breakers' best efforts, had remained unsolved for 70 years.
Yeah.
The code was created by scientist Robert Henry Thulis, who passed away in 1984. Tell us about this code. What was it used for?
Well, there's a great backstory to this. So starting in the 1890s, there was a lot of psychical research in the UK. Like, people were very interested to know, can you communicate with the dead? Mm-hmm. So they'd hold seances, they'd get mediums, and you'd go and see a medium and you'd say, can you transmit a message from my loved one to me? But so the Society for Psychical Research was founded in the UK in the 1890s. And people were always thinking about ways to prove that there was life after death. So this Cambridge professor, Robert Thulis, he proposed a method where he would publish three ciphers, so encrypted text, and he would use a key from a famous piece of literature for each of the ciphers, and then he would destroy all evidence of the key. He'd remember it, and then after he died, he would try to transmit the key via a medium. And then that would be the only way that
what a great story.
Yeah.
So perhaps predictably, the seance didn't produce the key.
Well, it was a great idea, because what people were doing before this was they were like sealing an object in an envelope, and the medium would say, "Oh, I think it's like a comb." But once you open up the envelope and it's actually a toothbrush, well, that's the end of that experiment.
Mm.
So this was a great idea. So the problem was that maybe he forgot it after he died, or he couldn't get it through to people. So, but yeah, once you are able to crack the code, then you have retrieved the key, and maybe it does prove that he survived death.
So how did you crack it? Did you communicate with him on the other side?
Well, my efforts weren't really successful, but when I enlisted the help of a computer, one of his three ciphers was a book cipher. So the first cipher was what was called a Playfair. It was sold within a few weeks. And the second cipher was a double Playfair that was sold in 1995 by computer. So I thought, well, this is a book cipher, so the key is from some book. So there's a huge library of online books called Project Gutenberg, where volunteers have been typing in books for decades, and now there are about 60,000 books, hundreds of gigabytes. So I decided to download all of this to my computer and see if any of the phrases in the books produced any recognizable English text in the output. And
you've got a fairly sizable computer by the sound of it.
Yeah. Well, it's only become possible in recent years because of the computational power required, the networking you need to download all this stuff, and so the power required to recognize the English text. But I did see, slices of English text in some of the output. And I eventually realized that he'd used a poem called The Hound of Heaven by Francis Thompson to to encrypt his text. So that was meant to be the key he was transmitting from the afterlife.
Very good. Can we just get some terms right here? I mean, the code is the thing, isn't it? So you were the word cipher and key. What can you explain? Can we explain those for us?
Yeah, I would say like code and cipher can be used in similar ways, but a key is what you, in this case, it's like a series of numbers or a series of words that you use
that you have to have
to change. So you have the plain text, the original English text, and you have this sequence of numbers or words called the key, and you use both of them together and you get this cipher text out. So yeah, and then the idea is when you have the cipher text and the key and you know how the algorithm worked, then you can go backwards and get the original text.
We're talking about cracking codes tonight and code breaking with Dr. Richard Bean from the University of Queensland's Redback Technologies Research Centre, who you just heard speaking, and also Graham Farr, a professor at the Faculty of IT at Monash University. I want to get back to Alan Turing in a moment. Just before we do that, though, Richard, you also cracked an IRA code from the 1920s. Tell me about that one.
Yeah. So the link between this and the Thales code is a guy called Jim Galogli, a computer scientist in California. So he became super famous in the 1990s when he solved three of the four passages from the encrypted Cryptos sculpture at the CIA. But he also wrote a book in 2008 with a historian, Tom Mann. It was called Decoding the IRA. So what happened was there was a chief of staff of the IRA in the 1920s called Moss Toomey. And he wrote, he had thousands of encrypted messages written in transposition ciphers. So transposition is about scrambling the text, basically, systematically. And then in about 2001, the historian Tom Mann came across these, and he got into contact with Jim Galogli, who'd solved the second Thales cipher and the Cryptos ciphers. And Jim Galogli made very short work of thousands of these ciphers, but there was one he couldn't crack, which he put as a challenge in his book. So I decided, you know, I would take a look at it. And over about a year, I developed what I would call frequency tables to help me solve these. So what a frequency table is, it helps you decide what are common and rare slices of English text. Mm-hmm. So, for example, THE is a very common three-letter slice of English text, but QXZ hardly ever occurs. And so the idea is that you are able to rearrange this text so that you can get, you can maximize the number of the slices like TAG and minimize the number of slices like QXZ. And so what made this so difficult was that it was very short. It was only 52 characters, and there were several mistakes in it. So what eventually happened was I was using slices of English that were six letters long, and I noticed that in a lot of the solutions I was seeing lignit, L-I-G-N-I-T, and when I forced that, I knew that from the context of this book, the IRA was involved in arms dealing, so I forced gelignite to be in the solution. And so with a bit of manual guidance, I was able to find the solution to this cipher involving gelignite smuggling.
Graham, can we get back to Alan Turing? I mean, he worked out how to break the version of the Enigma code used by the German Navy. Now, his colleagues at Bletchley Park, of course, many of them thought it was simply too hard. Why was the Enigma code so difficult to crack anyway?
Yes, it was a the German Navy used a particularly difficult version of the Enigma code. I mentioned before that the Enigma machine had these three wheels inside that introduced complicated ways of substituting for the letters of the alphabet in a hopefully unpredictable fashion. But the German Navy had an extra wheel in the machine, and they were pretty good at using it. This also was very militarily important to the British because of the role of the Nazi regime's U-boats in sinking convoys that were going across the Atlantic to keep Britain supplied and fed. So it was a desperate need, and yet in technical terms, the problem was seen as too hard. It was in the too hard basket, which is pretty much why Turing took it on. It was important, but it was also something he could sort of have to himself for a while. So a lot of the theoretical work had already been done by some Polish mathematicians who made some key breakthroughs in the theory of Enigma before the war. And so a lot of, they deserve a lot more of the credit than they sometimes get. But that was for the three-wheel Enigma, and the four-wheel Enigma needed something extra. So Turing was able to develop some of the mathematics required, but one of the extra ingredients it needed was some sort of automatic computational capability, or a greater automatic computational capability. The Poles, again, had made some steps in that direction using a machine they called the Bomba, which was a type of Polish ice cream, apparently, but there was this machine they used to help go through all the many, or a large subset of the many possibilities they needed to examine to try to work out which was the right one. But Turing took that to a much higher level, and these very powerful, or powerful by the standards of the day, Bomba machines were built at Bletchley Park to examine the many different possible internal configurations of the naval Enigma.
So these were kind of like an early computer, weren't they?
An early computer in a very special purpose sense. So I guess we typically reserve the term computer for a more general purpose programmable device, but certainly an early special purpose.
So Turing really, that's right. He was making one of, what he was doing actually, was making one of an early computer, but for a particular purpose.
For a very special purpose. He very much had in mind the possibilities for machines to compute more generally. He'd already developed one of the most important theoretical models of computation, what's become known as the Turing machine, an abstract mathematical model. He did that in his work at Cambridge in the mid-1930s. And he went on after the war to be involved in the development of one of Britain's first actual general purpose computers. So he had computing in a general sense on his mind throughout, but yes, in the war, it was a more special purpose computer that he developed.
How vital was it that they found one of these machines from a German submarine?
Very important, very important.
Could they have cracked it without the machine?
Potentially, but it would have been a lot more work. Cryptography works on the standard assumption that sooner or later, the people who are trying to analyze your machines will work out how your machine works. So the first step of cryptography is to design a code that will hopefully be secure even if your opponents work out how your machine works. So there's a long-standing principle that the security of a crypto system should not depend on keeping the nature of the system itself secret.
Oh, okay. So even though you have you might have one of the machines, you still don't know what's going to come out of it.
That's right, because of the unknown key. So Richard before was talking about the key being this ingredient that you mix with the plain text that you want to encrypt to produce the hopefully unreadable ciphertext. So it's really keeping that key itself secret that lies at the heart of cryptography.
I know we're jumping around here a bit, and I will go to some calls in a moment too. Richard, I'd like to come back to you for an Australian angle here. Eric Nave, who was a cracker code breaker, he was an Australian, wasn't he? Tell me about him.
Right, yes. So there's a book about him recently called A Man of Intelligence by Ian Fenningworth. And yes, he became a captain in the Royal Navy, and during World War II, he was the uber codebreaker for the Australians. So he was based in Brisbane during World War II at what was called Central Bureau, and they were breaking all the Japanese codes. But he was so valuable to the Australians that the Royal Navy they tried to get him back, but they invented all these different excuses, and he did have developed some health problems when he was in Southeast Asia. They didn't want to let go of him because he was so vital to the work. And after the war, he looked a bit at the so-called Somerton Man Code and diagnosed things like that. So he was an expert linguist and a natural code breaker more than a mathematician.
Did he break the Somerton Code? I thought that hadn't been solved.
No. But what his comment on that was that it seemed to be the initials of just common words written down somewhere. So it wasn't a statistical analysis. It was just using his intuition about what he saw.
Yeah. Yes, back to Alan Turing, Graham. I mean, World War II was an absolute turning point for code breaking because, as you say, that's when machines started to crack codes, wasn't it? Until then, it had been humans. But Turing showed that if you had sufficient computational power, let's not maybe use the word computer at this stage, but if you had sufficient computational power, you could crack most codes.
Yes, and that's absolutely right. And it was both ways, really. It was the introduction of machines for doing military encoding for secret communications, and on the other side of the same coin, having machines doing the cryptanalysis. So it was the sort of industrialization of cryptography and code breaking.
Mm. Let's take a few calls. I mean, a lot of people are finding this conversation very fascinating, as am I. Kel from Tangambalanga in northeast Victoria. G'day, Kel.
Hey,
there you go. Hi, Kel.
Yeah, well, am I overmodulating here? Speaking too loudly?
No, you're going fine, Kel. What's your question?
Yeah, well, I don't have a question, but just a comment.
Mm.
I've known a bloke who he did signals intelligence, signals intercepts, and in the Pacific.
Yeah,
and he sent a lot of his stuff down to Raph Frognall, down in Mount Albert there. For crypto analysis, and what he had was a problem with the Japanese. Their alphabet was so large, compared to the Latin alphabet, and the Japanese would this was in Morse code, of course. This is in the Second World War. And they would transmit so quickly that they had so much trouble writing it down and then sending it down to Raph Frognall in Melbourne.
Mm.
Quite a story.
Yeah. It is. Thanks, Kel. Yeah, it is a great story. I mean, the story of cracking Japanese codes, Graham, was quite something, wasn't it? The code that cracked the signals that General Yamamoto received, for example, was hugely significant.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of the code breaking in the Pacific theater of war was, based on breaking codes of the nature where substitutions were made for what I might call linguistic units. So, when you get into the sort of terminology of this field, cryptology, there's a distinction between codes and ciphers. And ciphers are where you encrypt down at the level of individual letters. And codes are where you take entire words or phrases and syllables and encode them according to some code book that you've got.
Yep.
And a lot of the work that the Australians were involved in the Second World War with the Japanese communications was of the code type rather than the cipher machine. So, I mean, they would have had both, but there was more the emphasis of the Australian work. It was a bit different in nature generally to the sort of technology they worked on at Bletchley Park.
Yeah. Steve from Parks. G'day, Steve.
Yeah, g'day, Philip. G'day, Professor Bean and Professor Farr. Look, I've got a question for you. I wanted to bring your high level of skills and expertise to the modern day. Something that affects millions of Australians, businesses and government departments is hackers and scammers and these dreadful email ransom scams. Professor Bean and Professor Barr, can these the coding, encrypted text, coding algorithms, coding keys, coding ciphers, could that be tracked back to its original sources when they hack governments and hack businesses and possibly form a joint strike task force with our ASIO, the FBI and the United States and the Interpol to track these coding back to the original source and get these people arrested and before the courts?
Yep.
There are millions of dollars in damage to government and to big business around the world.
They do. They do. Is there a connection between that kind of hacking and coding, Graham or Richard?
Yeah. The idea of some of the so-called ransomware is that they break into your computer either automatically or manually, these gangs. And then some of the ransomware, the modus operandi is that it encrypts your files and they want you to send Bitcoin, which is, again, like a cryptocurrency to a certain address to get the key back to decrypt your files. But, yeah, it can be quite challenging to attribute the hacking to any particular person because a lot of it can be done automatically. So there are some, you know, hacking incidents like I think it was Sony. They say, well, you know, maybe it was North Korea that did it, but it can be really difficult to say for certain, like, who did that when you have very skilled actors.
Mm-hmm. Yep, sure. Bruce from Perth. G'day, Bruce. Hi, Bruce.
Oh, hello. Oh, hi. Thanks for the opportunity. I just wanted to ask a quick question about the quantum computing and traditional crypto that we have at the moment. The concept of privacy and security is totally out of the window when we have the capability like quantum computers and them being able to crack the communications. And of course, you know, we talked about Professor Turing and I think his contributions are all considerably highlighted, but not a lot of people talk about the contribution of Eastern Europeans in cracking their contribution in Enigma. So a bit of
we did talk about the Polish contribution before. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I must have missed that.
Yeah.
Definitely, it would be interesting to know about the future of privacy and security, especially in the privacy and security in our critical infrastructure that we have at the moment in light of Psaki and others.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, isn't it? Richard, maybe to you, in an era of supercomputers and maybe quantum computers, we're not there yet with quantum computers, are we? But is there such a thing as an uncrackable code anymore? I suppose, this question, maybe it's a philosophical question, is it? Is there such a thing as an uncrackable code anyway?
Code, okay. Yes, well, instead of answering about the part about quantum computers, I'll say yes, there is such a thing as an uncrackable code. It's called the one-time pad. So
what's that?
The key is completely randomly generated using, I don't know, some process like you see on the lotto number choosing machine or maybe radioactive electron counting. And then you use the key to encrypt this text. You only have one copy of this key for the recipient and the person who makes the code, the sender.
Okay.
And then... you know, each what you end up with is a situation where every plain text is equally likely. And if you don't have that key, then there's no way.
Okay. So is this what we call end-to-end encryption with, you know, I mean, I think there are many apps that use it. For example, WhatsApp is one, is a common one. Is that what is that what we're talking about with that?
No, not exactly. That wouldn't necessarily use one-time pad. So the one-time pad was used in diplomatic communication between, say, the American diplomats, or between when the Americans and the Soviets wanted to communicate and make sure everything was absolutely secure. But
saying is that that you send a message that can only be read by its recipient and can't be deciphered by anybody else.
Anybody who was intercepting the communication, if they didn't have the key, there would be no way that they could get back to the plain text. That's right.
Okay. What do we think about modern encryption techniques then? What are they based upon?
Well, all the modern encryption techniques, let's say, we'll make a point in time about 1975. They rely on computers, and all encryption algorithms, they rely on substitution. That's substituting one character or bit or letter for another, and transposition. That's mixing them around, and so what we find is that these days the algorithms are so complicated, they use up so much computational power, that it really isn't feasible to search for every possible key anymore.
Okay.
So what the attackers, intelligence agencies do is they insert back doors in the algorithm, or they break directly into the computer. So they want to read the text before it's encrypted or after it's decrypted, because it's just not feasible anymore to try to search through all the possible keys.
Okay, so the answer to the question of is there an uncrackable code is
yes,
there is, but it's of limited application in that sense though.
Yeah,
it sort of illustrates the point that you do pay a price for high security. So with the one-time pad that Richard's describing, you have to generate an amount of key material that is equal in size to the amount of data you want to encrypt.
Yep.
And, you know, for modern protection of, you know, files and communications and so on, that could be an absolutely massive amount, and it must have perfect properties of statistical randomness, which is mathematically and algorithmically not a trivial thing to do. So, you know, as somebody once said, the generation of random numbers is too important to be left to chance. So the one-time pad is, you know, has perfect security if used properly, but it's also quite expensive.
I think I can add to that. I just came up with that, you know, the lotto generation numbers on the fly there. But Graham's point is that you imagine something like the roulette table at casino. Like, there have been people who have brought in, you know, computers into the casino and worked out like biases in the roulette wheel. So you would think it was truly random, but actually it isn't. And you see very similar things happen in cryptography.
Hmm.
Yeah.
All right, 1-300-800-222. We're talking about code breaking. Richard Bean from University of Queensland and Graham Farr from Monash University are our guests. If you've got questions about code cracking or code breaking or codes generally, 1-300-800-222. Text on 0467922702. Deb says, we think Mum worked at Bletchley during the war, but she never told, having signed the Official Secrets Act. She was a genius at cryptic crosswords, which may be a clue. Is that a helpful skill, Graham?
It was seen as one of the indicators of possible talent in cryptanalysis. They used to talk in the British, British codebreaking community of the three C's: chess, crosswords, and classics.
Right.
That was I don't think you'd say the same thing nowadays, but that's going back to the sort of romantic era of cryptography where things were done manually, pencil and paper. So skill with crosswords was important, and a classical education perhaps was seen as important because it got you used to dealing with bodies of text in different languages and interpreting them and attacking them as a kind of detective and things like that. And chess obviously involves analytical thinking. Mm. But cryptography these days has changed. As we discussed before, it has seen the introduction of machines. The old pencil and paper ways are not really done in the most important industrial cryptography applications anymore. And it is very mathematical now as well.
Yes. What are you? I mean, something as commonplace as the Rubik's Cube, Richard. Is that a code, or is that just pattern recognition? How would you describe that? Because some people look at that and think, well, that'd be impossible to solve. And yet, I think the world record is less than 4 seconds or something.
Well, that's a good one to throw at me. The Rubik's Cube reminds me of my favorite area of mathematics. That's combinatorics. So I think that there are something like 10 to the 23 different arrangements of all the colors there. But there's something like God's algorithm, which can solve the Rubik's Cube in, I think it was at most 20 moves. So this sounds like getting back to the cryptography.
Yeah, I mean, there are humans.
You
there
don't
are
need to search through all the space.
Yeah, there are humans who, I mean, I think I'm right in saying that. The world record is, it's only seconds for solving it. So
seconds once you've had a good look at it, I think. I think under those sort of timing conditions, they have a good look at the cube, and that's kind of before the clock starts, and then they just do the manipulations in 4 seconds. The thinking might take a little longer. I don't know how much longer, but they're all much quicker than me after, so.
What's going on with that, though, with the Rubik's Cube? Is that kind of code cracking in the sense?
It's a puzzle, is it?
It's not a code so much as it's a puzzle. Or is
there, really call
is there
it a
difference?
Code? No, there's no real analog of the key there, I would say. I mean, in a code or cipher, you have a message that you want to conceal somehow, and you have some extra random information called the key, and you combine them to produce the cipher. What you've got there is simply a process of making something simple and elegant into something looking complicated and scrambled, and you have to invert that. There's not a sort of hidden key to discover. It's really just a process of inverting a complicated operation.
Mm. So the one thing that has come to mind is that there have been encryption algorithms proposed using Rubik's Cube principles the listeners might want to search for that themselves. So they can be related. Yeah.
Mm. Mill from Far North Queensland says, Phil, in a more colourful vein, I've just checked my ticket, pressing numbers on my phone, and it told me I'd won $17. Now it blows my mind. Yes. Well, if someone could crack the code for winning Lotto, I guess that would be the end of the game. wouldn't it? I mean, in Rubik's Cube, we would place Sudoku, I suppose, in the same vein, would we, Graham?
I think that's a good analogy. It's a puzzle. You've got to uncover the one solution that's been planted in there, and you have to go through a process of logical reasoning to uncover it. So puzzles are a broad class. You know, ciphers and codes may be thought of as a subclass of that broad class.
Mm. Looking ahead, Richard, our earlier caller, Bruce, I think it was from Perth, mentioned quantum computers. I mean, as I understand, we haven't really developed one yet, have we? We're trying to develop one. Explain what it is, what a quantum computer is. We haven't built one, but plenty of people are trying to build one. Explain what it is.
Well, you'd probably be better off asking a physicist, but they use quantum bits, qubits instead of bits, so they don't necessarily have like zeros and ones. They have probabilistic numbers, zero, one. Sometimes it's zero, sometimes it's one, and they are said to be able to like solve problems that ordinary computers these days just have no hope of doing. But, you know, sometimes it feels like the technology is always arriving and never here.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And the number of stories, I mean, it's a bit like reading stories on cold fusion, I think. You read stories continuously about them. Yeah, we mentioned Alan Turing, Graham. Just, I mean, we should maybe finish up right now, but it's coming towards the end of our discussion. But just talk some more about Alan Turing and the contribution he made, because he was appallingly treated in his personal life, wasn't he?
That's right. He was homosexual at a time when that was illegal and, you know, very against the prevailing standards of the day. Mm. He was not particularly discreet about it. He wasn't particularly open about it because he couldn't be, but those most who knew him were in his circle of friends knew something was going on. But of course, you know, in many ways he had to keep it secret from the wider circle. It didn't stop him being employed by the British government in order to do the wonderful work he did for Britain during the Second World War. Mm. But after the war, it became an issue. He was still working for them or maintaining a security clearance so that he could consult for them. But he was, you know, it's a bit of a long story, but he was you know, caught by the police and they found out he was homosexual, and so he was prosecuted under the laws that prevailed in Britain at the time. Tragically, he had to undergo a chemical treatment as an alternative treatment in inverted commas, as an alternative to imprisonment for being homosexual, and he endured that. He seemed to be regaining some sort of equilibrium and returning to productive research work, but in the early 50s, he was found dead one morning in his home. And the it's a bit controversial. The main view is that he took his own life at the end there. Mm. So he was, in effect, driven to death by the way he had been treated for just, you know, being who he was. And in a ghastly at any time, but especially considering what he had done for Britain and that he had indeed proved no security risk at all through doing what he did, and in fact quite the opposite, had been essential to the security of the entire country. So terrible end, tragic end. I should say that there is a minority view that it wasn't suicide, that it was an accident with some of the chemicals. He was fond of working with poisonous chemicals as a kind of hobby, and his mother, who was also one of his biographers, never accepted that it was suicide, and there are scholars who would argue against that. But it's the prevailing view at the as things stand.
Yes, all right. What the future of it, Richard, you say with powerful computing is that, you know, we are able now to produce uncrackable codes, that therefore powerful encryption is going to be more common rather than less.
Mm. Yes, but I think what we've seen, like through things like the WikiLeaks Vault 7 revelations, are that the encryption algorithms of today properly implemented, the signals intelligence agencies, they can't break them. Hmm. So what they do is they go around them. They insert back doors and things. So that's kind of their whole job is to it's more about, instead of brute force attacks on algorithms, it's about backdooring algorithms and getting into computers by subterfuge, basically.
Yeah. All right. Look, it's been a fascinating conversation. And thank you, Roger from Box Hill, who says, yes, if you haven't seen The Imitation Game, it's an excellent film starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Alan Turing. And yes, I've seen that as well and would recommend it. Richard Bean from UQ and Graham Farr from Monash, terrific to have you with us tonight and have your expertise. It's been fantastic and interesting conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Philip.
Thanks, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.